I call this meeting of the House Finance Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it's 1:36 p.m. on Thursday, March 26, 2026. Present today are Representative Allard, Representative Stapp, Representative Moore, Representative Hannon, Representative Tomaszewski, Representative Galvin, Co-Chair Foster, and myself, Co-Chair Josephson. Also present today are House Finance Committee staff, Committee Assistant Helen Phillips, Paige Tallulah-Lestefka, Secretary Bree Wiley, and Secretary Leah Frazier. We also have our moderator, Emily Mesh, from the Legislative Information Office. Before we start, please mute your cell phones. In today's meeting, we will hear the Department of Law present on monetary terms of agreement. Then we will hand the gavel over to hear public testimony on House Bill 210, Peace Officers / Firefighters Disability. We've been joined by Representative Bynum. Briefly, I want to remind committee members that the Department of Law is the employer's representative in completed and ongoing labor negotiations. Therefore, there may be questions it is unable to answer. With us today from the Department of Law is Rachel Witte, Director for the Civil Division. Director Witte, please come forward, put yourself on the record, and begin your presentation.
Good afternoon, Rachel Witte, Civil Division Director for the Department of Law. I'd like to thank the committee for inviting us to present today. I know that these presentations have typically taken place every year during legislative session to update the legislature on collective bargaining and labor agreements. And as you all are aware, Administrative Order 356 transferred certain functions of labor relations to the Department of Law in the fall of 2024, and we did not present last year. We were negotiating seven different agreements and also trying to staff up and coordinate that work, and so we weren't really in a position to come and present, and I appreciate the opportunity to be here today.
Director Witte, we've been joined by Representative Allard. Please continue.
I've not navigated this before. Thank you, Chair Josephson.
You have help.
I guess the space bar does it. Thank you. Okay. So I guess I did just reference Administrative Order 356. In September, it transferred certain functions from the Department of Administration. It used to be known as Doppler, the Division of Personnel and Labor Relations, and that order transferred certain portions of the labor relations work over to the Department of Law, and the objectives stated in the administrative order were to ensure legal oversight during labor negotiations, improve review of contract terms and proposals, strengthen support for the grievances, arbitrations, and contract interpretation processes, and to allow scaling the legal resources to fit like the ebbs and flows of the work. Stop me at any time if people have questions. And this is an organizational chart of the Civil Division that shows where labor relations sits in the Department of Law. And so we, a couple of years ago, the legislature approved an organizational change that divided the Civil Division into different components that are overseen by two different division directors. And I believe our Deputy Attorney General, Corey Mills, kind of gave an overview in previous Finance Committee hearings. But we have Charles Gartland, the division director that oversees, you know, some of the litigation and natural resource work. And then I oversee the government services, labor, health, and some of the support services. And so the labor relations unit, it used to be in the labor and state affairs section, but now we've carved it out and it's its own section and it's located in the labor, business, and corporations component. The labor, I guess I'll wait till I get to the next slide for this. The labor relations section is overseen by a labor relations manager, Matthew Gendrusina, and he just started at the end of September and he's getting up and running. That position was vacant when this unit was transferred over to the Department of Law, and so we recruited for that vacancy, and he's taken the helm, and he oversees four different labor relations analysts. We've also been able to work with Nancy Such. She was the former deputy director at the Division of Personnel, and she came on as a temp exempt employee and funded by the Department of Transportation to help coordinate the bargaining of all the marine contracts last year. And she's been working to support our efforts as we've still kind of onboarded with those contracts.
We have a question, Ms. Whitty, from Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Ms. Whitty, are these folks in this org chart here, the labor relations analyst and Mr. Gendrasena, are they all attorneys and in the Department of Law, or are they labor relations folks who came over with that division move?
Ms. Whitty.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, those are all non-attorney positions. And when the unit was transferred over to, or when the positions were transferred over to the Department of Law, two of the positions were filled shortly after the transfer. We were down to one analyst. And so we've staffed up to hire four analysts who are all in the classified service. They're all part of the Confidential Employees Association. And then Matthew Gendrasena is not an attorney, but he is a PX employee.
One follow-up?
Follow-up. Rep. Hannon for Director Whitty.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justin. And Ms. Whitty, is that the same number of positions that did this work when they were at Big Admin?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, we did not receive some of the, I think there were some support services, some, you know, like law, I guess, in my parlance, there are law office assistants, but, you know, maybe more like admin staff that would deal with filing and records review, and we did not receive those positions. And so that's something we're still trying to figure out if we need to add additional support so that the work has someone to help with, you know, document management and some of the other admin support functions.
Follow-up, Rep. Hannon for Director Whitty.
I'm looking to see if we had four labor relations analysts doing this work when it was over at the Department of Administration, or if we had five and they only gave you four because they're like, you're lawyers, you'll do better, or were there two and now we need four?
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, the number of labor relation analyst positions was the same over at the Department of Administration, but for a while those positions were also vacant. I think they were at a 50% vacancy rate, and so it's been a while since the unit has been fully staffed.
Thank you.
Okay. Slide five.
And this just states the mission of the labor relations work group. We represent the state in contract negotiations, contract administration, and all other shared concerns of the state and the unions representing its employees. We prevent and resolve conflicts with transparency, consistency, and fairness while protecting the state's interests and limited resources. And our goal is to foster a productive and positive work environment by managing the relationship between the state, its employees, and their representatives.
Okay. Slide six.
And this slide just states some of the services that we provide. We represent the state in contract negotiations. And I should say for all of these things, it's a close collaboration between the labor relations analysts and attorneys at the Department of Law. And so, you know, it might depend on the particular task as to whether an analyst is taking the lead and the attorney is on standby, or whether, you know, it makes sense for the attorney to kind of slide into the lead role and the analyst is more of a supporting role. But we, in addition to contract negotiations, I'll stop there and elaborate a little. We've tried to staff up our negotiation teams to always have one attorney on the team, one analyst, and then a chief negotiator. Sometimes it's been an attorney. Sometimes it's been a non-attorney. We interpret and administer collective bargaining agreements, analyze and administer letters of agreement, and I can provide a little more detail on that. We respond to grievances and disputes, represent the state in arbitration, mediation, and other dispute resolutions, represent the state before the Alaska Labor Relations Agency, provide training and advice to other departments, administer labor management committees, and build working relationships with the unions representing state employees.
Director Witte, on slide five, you talk about protecting the state's interests. That of course could mean offering generous compensation, increases where, for example, salaries are not competitive and the work is critical, and all those would go into the state's analysis as well, correct?
Chair Josephson, that's correct. Taking into account resources, you know, looking at comparators for that type of work and the need for operational integrity, all those interests coming into play.
And a question on letters of agreement, which you've note on slide six. Who has to, first of all, what is the current policy of the Dunleavy administration on letters of agreement, as you understand it?
Chair Josephson, the letters of agreement the policy has undergone some change over the past year, and I heard questions from finance committees last year about letters of agreement. There's been a tremendous effort to centralize those and keep them. All of the requests for letters of agreement now flow through the Department of Law. Agencies are requested to provide supporting documentation, supporting the need, that there is no other way of accomplishing whatever goal is set out in the letter of agreement, metrics into how they're going to be tracked to see if they're effective. So I think this past year, and can't remember if it's on a future slide, but at the end of June, at the end of June 2025, all letters of agreement expired, and there was a reset, and departments were asked to submit requests instead of carrying over from year to year. They had to submit a request signed off by the commissioner and provide supporting documentation. And I think there were maybe over 100, maybe even close to 120 different requests. And I think only 47 of those letters of agreement were approved.
Yeah, let me follow up on that. That's interesting. So when you say that letters of agreement expired at the end of June 2025, is that because it was sort of an uncanny thing where they just all happened to expire? Or were they sort of force expired? Were they interrupted?
Chair Josephson, the terms of the letters of agreement were always intended to run with the fiscal year, and they normally had a expiration date of the end of the fiscal year. But for some of them, for whatever reason, they were allowed to continue. And so through like past practice, some of the letters of agreement continued to be honored beyond their expiration date. And it created some ambiguity as to what terms were controlling the department and the unions. So for clarification, notices went out to all departments that all letters of agreement and particular lists were provided for each department as to which ones they had outstanding, that those would be expiring. And if the departments wanted to continue, they would have to make a request for a new letter of agreement that would start at the beginning of the next fiscal year.
So it was more like a pause, in effect.
Chair Josephson, yes, that sounds accurate.
And you're saying that about 47 out of 120 have been largely restored? Is that the numbers you gave?
Chair Josephson, I don't know about restored. Some of them were new requests. Some of them we found were similar to each other. And so we were able to combine and have just one letter of agreement that would provide similar terms rather than having, five or six that seemed sort of similar. And so just a general effort to try and winnow these down and clamp down on the use of all these stray agreements that were making it hard to track, for budget purposes and also just for administration purposes, what was in effect.
Okay, but just to get the numbers repeated, it was about 47 out of 120? Is that what you said?
Chair Josephson, I would like to follow up, if I can, after this hearing and provide you the accurate numbers. I think that's an estimate. I can tell you there were over 100 requests, and I think that there are currently 46 or 47 that are in effect.
Okay. Thank you for all those questions. Please continue.
And this is just a list of the current contracts that are administered, but well, all the bargaining units affecting state employees. Right now, the two that are being negotiated are both of them are with the Public Safety Employees Association. One of them is for the troopers, and the other is for the airport airport police and fire officers. And so, and this is, you know, we organize them on our website. They're organized alphabetically, but here I had them grouped according to when they expire. And so you'll see that coming up next year, we'll have LTC, Labor Trades and Crafts, and also the supervisory unit are the ones that will be coming up next term. And again, we have that big chunk of seven different agreements that will be coming up again, expiring the end of 2028.
Director Witte, since I don't see other hands, I have a question about the two pending negotiations. So the finance co-chairs, I know, have a sort of supposed deadline when we need to receive from OMB, I guess, the terms of a contract so that we can put them in a conference committee report or a budget bill. I think that's in mid-April, something like that. First of all, do you think that deadline will be met as to these two unions?
Chair Josephson, I know that both the parties are working very actively towards that goal. They are going to be negotiating all next week in person negotiations to try and close this out. So everyone is aware of the deadline and working hard to achieve it.
Okay. And am I right, Director Witte, that if we leave town before Memorial Day, as we're sort of required to do, we can hang out here, of course, and enjoy Juneau. Yeah. But if we leave town and we have not added these, and there is an increase that is signed, say, the 1st of June, typically those, for example, troopers and airport police and fire would get one sort of large compensation check the following May, perhaps? Is that how that would work?
Chair Josephson, I think it might vary by union, the terms of the contract. I would have to, I thought I had that printed out here in front of me. I can't place my hands on it right now. So I can follow up with you on that.
Okay. But if the appropriation isn't made, and yet effective July 1 of 26, a trooper receives 3% more, then without that appropriation, they can't get that paycheck until typically it'd be May of 27. And so the checks would build up and they would get, you know, each trooper might get $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, I'm guessing, in a large sum. I'm just throwing out a number. Is that sort of how that would work?
Again, Chair Josephson, I don't want to say for sure because I know that there are some agreements where there is no retroactive pay increases. So if the legislature doesn't approve it within the time frame, they don't get to go back and the employees don't get to go back and get the retroactive pay. But I don't know on this one.
That's an important term of any bargain for sure. Sounds like Representative Hannon.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Ms. Witte, we have in our packet attached to your PowerPoint, or in addition to your PowerPoint, three settled contracts, one from arbitration, and I see it listed on this list of current contracts because it's the Alaska Corrections Officers that went to an arbitration. The other two contracts I don't see listed under contracts on your list, so I am wondering where they fall. And they're both APEA contracts, but I am wondering, under each of the contracts listed here, are there a subset of 10 that are being potentially bargained, or?
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, the other two contracts that were submitted are university contracts, and I understand no one from the university is here today to answer questions about those contracts, but under statute, it used to be that the Commissioner of Administration was responsible for reviewing and forwarding those agreements to the legislature. And now with labor relations at law, I had forwarded those to the legislature on behalf of the university.
One follow-up.
Follow-up. Rep Hannon for Director
Whitty. Thank you for that. Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. And so, Ms. Whitty, the UA contracts are not the responsibility, and their duties to negotiate those was not transferred to the Department of Law. They remain the university and the Board of Regents' responsibilities, correct?
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, that's correct.
Thank you.
Director, I had a conversation with someone, and it may have been APEA, or rather, let me retract, it may have been PSEA. Is the Department of Law retaining a Chicago law firm as to some of the bargaining unit negotiations?
Chair Josephson, yes. The law firm of Clark Baird Smith in Chicago, they're specialists in labor relations, and they have been leading the negotiations with PSCA as we attempt to build more capacity in-house at the Department of Law.
Was Ms. Sheehan, when she did much of this at Department of Administration, did she need to hire out contract counsel? Do you have any knowledge of that?
Chair Josephson, I do believe that the contract with Clark Baird Smith was also ongoing during the time that Kate Sheehan handled many of these negotiations. It might have shifted in terms of who the bargaining chief was and whether Clark Baird was more in a legal support role instead of leading the negotiations. But I don't know that they were involved with PSEA, but I know they've been involved with several of our contracts.
Do you know the hourly rate of Clark Barrett Smith?
Chair Josephson, I don't know it off the top of my head. I can supplement that.
I'd like that. Any other questions from the committee? All right, so let's move on to slide 8.
And this is just kind of a snapshot view. I think that Deputy Attorney General Corey Mills provided this information in one of her overviews, perhaps to the law subcommittee, of just some of the activities that we've accomplished over the past year when labor relations has been at law. As I stated earlier, you know, 7 contracts were negotiated. We've resolved 62 grievances. 4 of those grievances were class action grievances affecting many employees. We had 1 arbitration.
Okay. Representative Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Justin. Through the chair to Director Whitty, thanks for being here. So while we're on the topic of grievances and disputes, I'm just kind of curious. You know, most of the folks that I've talked to in my district, the biggest problem that they had for a while was basically getting their paychecks on time, right? So I'm curious if you guys are still dealing with notice of pay problems and how many of those notice of pay problems have not been resolved past the contractual date for resolution through the chair.
Director Whitty.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. Yes, those were the class action. I think the majority of the class action resolutions referred to on the previous slide. I think in a close collaboration with payroll and the Department of Administration, our labor relations analysts and attorneys work to clear the backlog and then find a negotiated resolution to get compensation for those employees for the delay in their pay. I haven't seen a snapshot of the current dashboard over to know what the current state of play is with payroll, but I know that substantial improvements were made.
Okay, follow up, Mr. Co-Chair.
Yes, follow up. Yeah, Stanford, Director Whitty.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Justin, through the Chair, Director Whitty. So just to be clear, you aren't aware of how many kind of notice of pay problems that are currently out there right now that are beyond the contractual date for resolution?
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, I'm not aware we can also work with Department of Administration to provide those numbers.
Okay. Mr. Kocher.
Follow up.
Yeah, it'd be great if you could get those to me at your future date. So the second kind of line of question through the chair is regarding how we kind of prevent another payback log. You mentioned that you guys had made a lot of progress, and obviously I'm getting far less phone calls of people not getting paid, so it seems like that's probably true. But I'm curious, kind of what is the plan going forward to address any of, you know, ongoing pay problems that are beyond the resolution date, and kind of what the division has done to ensure that we don't have a bunch of angry people who aren't getting paid in the future, through the chair.
Director Whitty.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, I think that, I mean, some of those questions might be for payroll or the Department of Administration, but we at Labor Relations have been working closely, having regular biweekly meetings with payroll to talk about issues that are coming up and how to respond in a timely way. We do those grievances. We try to prioritize and clear them out right away. We've tried to identify if there are issues that are causing like recurring NOPPs that because of an interpretation, trying to clear that up, and then having payroll reprogram their system if it's a definition in that's unclear. So I know that they've been working really. I know they've been working to update the information that they have on their website, so that when people go in, it's clear they can use a drop-down menu to flag what sort of issue that they're having, rather than just, you know, everything going into the same bucket. And it's made it easier to respond to the particular issue in a more timely way.
Okay, and last fault, Mr.
Yep,
Kocher.
Follow up. Rep. Yeah. Stafford, Director Wheaton.
Yeah, thank you, Kocher. Justin, through the chair, and obviously I know that some of these are going to be admin questions, but just for you at Labor Relations, was there any discussion of, like, in my head, I'm thinking of, like, tangible ways to avoid this problem in the future, like maybe a call center for employees, or tracking the no-pay requirements, like, online, or, like, a digitization of payroll records, any of that type of stuff? To look at mitigating this problem in the future, through the chair.
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, I can tell you I've been involved in meetings when all of those things have been discussed. I know that we also have been working with the unions to educate employees. So if when they're submitting their time slips, there are things that we can do to help make sure that they don't get in the wrong pile. And so it's been a collaborative effort between labor relations, the unions, and payroll and admin.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Galvin.
Thank you. Through the chair, very briefly, you mentioned an acronym that I didn't understand. I think you said AOPCs, maybe to do with on-time paychecks, but I'm not sure. When answering to Representative Stapp, the acronym that I heard, I think, was AOPC, but I don't know what it stands for.
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, did I say NOPP, Notice of Pay Problem?
Maybe that was it. NOPP. Okay. Thank you.
Director, back on the subject of letters of agreement, if, for example, at OCS, where there's chronic understaffing, and they will tell you that there's chronic understaffing. If they wanted to use vacant positions and give $5,000 pay bumps with letters of agreement, would that go through the chief of staff or the governor to you? Or what is the route of Director Guay's request?
Chair Josephson, actually, we recently worked with the Department of Administration and the Governor's Office to put all requests for letters of agreement onto a platform that's the same ServiceNow platform that I think the IT uses for tickets. And so the department would submit it through that system, and the first stop on the way goes to Labor Relations. copies of the request also go to the Division of Finance and to the Division of Personnel. And so if it impacts either of those work groups, they also take a look and they're able to provide any input on what type of effect it might have, how it would be implemented. And then a recommendation is made to the governor's office from there. Goes through OMB. OMB talks about whether, evaluates it for fiscal impact, and then the chief of staff.
Okay. I think I saw Rep. Stapp first, then Hannon. Rep. Stapp.
Yeah, thank you, Coach Aaron, Justin, through the chair. Yeah, sorry about this. I just kind of dawned on me that if you're not paying people on time and you have a contractual agreement to pay them on time, do we pay these people penalties for when we don't pay them on time? And are we doing that, or does that actually got to go through like arbitration and all that stuff in the grievances? Like, I guess these 62 grievances, how many of those are like pay? And if we're paying people not on time, how does that work through the chair?
Director Whitty.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp. I should have taken notes. There were a couple parts to the question.
Yeah, I can rephrase too if you'd like.
Sure. No, I think so. Yes, people do file a grievance if they have a note. They can file a grievance if there's a notice of pay problem. I think payroll attempts to resolve that right away when it comes in before it would hit that that mark. But if it isn't resolved within a certain amount of time, then the different contracts have different provisions as to whether or not penalty pay is owed and under what conditions, if it's a pay shortage. And so the employee might be entitled to penalty pay. I can tell you in the class action grievances that we resolved, several employees did receive their penalty pay for the late payments.
Okay, just a quick clarification.
Yep, clarification.
Yeah. Thank you, Coach Justin. So just to be clear, probably not in all cases, but in most cases, most of these people, like if we don't pay them on time beyond a certain contractual date, we owe them penalty pay. And to the best of your knowledge, we're paying them the penalty pay in the event that we owe them. Or do they have to actually go through the grievance process and arbitration process to get the penalty pay through the chair?
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, there might be a contract interpretation question as to whether or not that is a pay shortage that would entitle them to some sort of penalty pay. I think there's if they're owed an amount, for instance, for a late performance evaluation, and they'll eventually get whatever pay they were entitled to, but that might not trigger the penalty pay provision for pay shortage under a contract, for instance.
Follow up. Rep. Stapp for Director Whitty.
Yeah, thank you, Coach. Sorry about this. I don't know anything about contract law. I know this is complicated, but what does that mean if the penalty is defined in the contract? Because to me, like, I'm like simple brained, you know. I figure like if somebody's supposed to get their paycheck on Friday and they don't get their paycheck till like next month, you know, we should probably compensate them somehow, and I'm sure that's in their contracts. But what do you mean by contract interpretation, through the chair?
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Stapp, that example you gave right there is, of course, a very easy example. If someone doesn't get their paycheck at all, that would be an issue that would entitle them to penalty pay, and we would want to do that before they even would have to file a grievance. But there might be something that they are that they think that they were, their pay might not be as much as they expected if they submitted like travel receipts, but maybe the travel receipts weren't submitted in the right way or to the right place, or they didn't submit them timely. There might be a delay in their pay there, and that might not necessarily entitle them to penalty pay.
Okay, thank you.
Rep. Hannon, then Galvin.
Thank you, Coach Josephson. On the same theme, but less specific, we've had a number of state departments that in this budget cycle for FY27 are receiving back to their department from, and I always call it big admin, payroll, personnel, and accounting authority. I have asked most agencies that are doing that, whether they think that will help with some of the problems of timely pay that they've had. was labor relations? Was this were you able to participate in that in settling grievance and saying if you did your own payroll, perhaps there would be fewer grievances about delayed pay? Or is it just coincidence that this decentralization effort for many of the agencies that have multiple contracts is happening simultaneously with the number of grievances and class actions on timely payroll?
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, labor relations was not involved in that decision to move or to decentralize payroll. My understanding is there were certain departments that wanted to take that responsibility back in-house and thought that they might be able to better manage it if they were aware of, you know, the way their employees' work schedules worked or what, you know, the way their travel worked and having everything, you know, all under the same roof. They thought maybe some efficiencies could be gained, but labor relations wasn't involved in that effort. I don't know. I think it's not a coincidence that it happened, you know, in close proximity to some of these notice of pay problems. The agencies probably thought that they might be able to handle it more efficiently and wanted to give it a try.
Okay. Thank you.
Rep. Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Justice, and through the chair. I also have, I was going to go there with regard to decentralization and why, because I know it's gone back and forth over the decades. So to sort of understand that would have been nice, but it sounds like that's not an issue that you know a lot about in terms of the why this time. But in terms of the NOPPs or notice of payment problems, I see that you've given us a list of grievances, class actions, and such, but I wondered if you had any sense of, because I don't know how broad, this is the first I'm hearing about our problems of not, of payment problems, paying on time, et cetera. So could you know how many NOPPs that the state has seen this year, and is that a substantial jump from the past, or if you have any data over the last few years, that would be great if you know of that.
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I will, I think Representative Stapp also asked for some numbers on that. And so we'll pull some data. I know that there was, you know, post COVID, there were a number of vacancies in the payroll staff, and it took a while to staff up again. I think they contracted out some of that work, and then the new contractor came in, and there were more issues, but I know that within the last year, significant efforts were made to reduce that, and I know that we have data that we can provide.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yes, follow-up.
And thank you. So what I was trying to get at is not necessarily the why, but how big is this problem? So if I could just know a sense of how it's looking, maybe it's already resolved. So if we could see a timeline of how many problems there were, you know, a few years ago versus last year and this year, maybe that would help us to see, as I don't know, Chair, if this has already kind of been resolved somehow, or if it's still an issue that's hanging out there. Well, I think it would be helpful to know. Thank you.
All right, let's go to slide 10, I think is where we're going. Tell me if I'm wrong.
Yes, Chair Justice, if I could just one other caveat on the NOPPs, that is within the province of payroll. I will work with them to get the data, but that isn't something necessarily that the Department of Law tracks.
Okay.
So is this number 10? Are we on 10?
That
or do you want
nine.
Me to proceed? Okay. And so now we're moving into the bargaining process, and this just kind of outlines our general process that, you know, starting late fall, the parties begin to negotiate successor agreements and, you know, with the goal, of course, of getting those any monetary terms to the legislature in a timely manner so that the legislature can review and fund. And if for some reason the parties are not able to reach an agreement, different contracts have, you know, different specifics on this, but generally speaking, if the parties aren't able to reach an agreement after, you know, working in good faith for whatever reason, if they reach an impasse on a mandatory term of bargaining, such as, you know, compensation or something affecting the terms and conditions of employment, and the parties go to impasse, the Public Employment Relations Act requires that the parties then try to mediate. If that's not successful, then they can go to interest arbitration.
Okay. Slide. We have a question from Rep. Bynum for Director Witte.
Yes, thank you, Co-Chair Justice, and through the Chair, Director Witte. Thank you for being here. When we go back to slide 10, we talk a little bit about the process, and I'm just trying to get a better understanding of the legislature's role, because what it feels like has happened since I've been here is that all these processes are happening, and then we basically get a contract in front of us, and it's to say accept this or reject this. And it's already after all the work has been done. And I don't recall a time where we were engaged in the process prior to that to get some level of input and or priorities of the legislature directly before that process starts, which is very different than my experience of, say, working with a borough assembly. Although as an assembly member, I never had the direct negotiation, and I also didn't have outline all the specific needs of a department. We did give some level of guidance on what our goals and objectives were to the administration. And that just seems backwards here that we get this after the fact, and it's almost as a, here it is, you take this, all the negotiation is done, and if we reject it, then it creates this problem back into the department to correct it. So I was just hoping to get a little bit of feedback from you on the process and our role.
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Bynum, I don't know that there's any, I mean, the statute just requires the presentation of monetary terms. So, you know, we do follow the statute, but, I think in addition, I can offer that, we labor relations heard the legislature loud and clear last, session when there was some consternation over the proliferation of LOAs and not being able to wrangle, like, what is the total cost of this contract if there's all these one-off LOAs. And so we have really made a concerted effort. The administration has to rein that in and try and, centralize the bargaining in the contract itself instead of negotiating a contract and then after the fact having all of these additional side agreements.
Director, along with your negotiating team in this Chicago law office, are there other individuals that don't work for the Department of Law that aid the administration in negotiations?
Representative Josephson, yes. John Wood is under contract with the Department of Law, and he has deep expertise in the area of labor relations and is a member of the bargaining teams.
For all of the negotiations or for specific negotiations?
Chair Josephson, he is a member of every bargaining team.
Is he the lead on the team or is he a participant on the team?
Chair Josephson, he's a participant.
Rep. Hannon.
Thank you, Chair Josephson. Could you show me, Ms. Whitting, back on the org chart where John Wood lies, or is he a complete contract employee to the Department of Law just on bargaining?
Director.
Through the Chair, Representative Hannon, he's not on the org chart. He's an independent contractor. And I'll just offer that prior to labor relations moving to the Department of Law, he was under contract, I believe, with the Department of Administration.
Follow up.
Rep. Hannon.
And could you tell me, is that considered a full-time contract? Is he available to you 37 and a half hours a week, or is it only part-time?
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, his hours vary according to the ebbs and flows of bargaining. They're, you know, right now it's a particularly heavy bargaining time, so his hours are, you know, higher, but, you know, maybe in August might only be a few hours a month.
One more follow-up.
Follow-up, Rep. Hannon for Director Witte.
Do you know, is his contract with the state a per-hour contract or is it a flat-rate contract?
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, it's a power leave contract.
And one more?
Yes, Rep. Hannon.
Do you know the rate of that contract per hour?
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I should know, I'm the project manager on the contract, but the number escapes me right now. So I have offered to provide the committee with the hourly pay for the Clark Baird contract, and I will do that with the John Wood contract as well.
Thank you.
Thank you. Director, we're nearing the end, but I have some softball questions, and I apologize. They may be so elementary that you're wondering why I'm asking. Broadly speaking, public employees are exempt, partially exempt, or classified. Do I have that right?
Chair Josephson, yes, that's correct.
All right. And exempt are often, although not always, they're sometimes political appointees like commissioners and deputy commissioners who serve at the pleasure of the administration. So I don't think anyone thinks of exempt as creating bargaining units, because it's just odd to consider. Are there partially exempt employees in bargaining units?
Chair Josephson, no, there are not.
Nowhere in the 17,000 employees are there any partially exempt in bargaining units.
Chair Josephson, I am also new to this, so okay. I am not aware of any.
So we see in the university system an increase in bargaining units. Could that happen in the state? Is there anything prohibiting partially exempt workers from trying to organize? I'm not encouraging it or discouraging it. I'm just curious.
Chair Josephson, I'm not aware of anything that would prohibit them.
Okay. All right. So we've hit slide 10 fairly well. Should we go to slide 11?
Yes. So this, I think, is this my final slide? In any event, this just kind of plays out what the different terms are of the different agreements in the event that, an agreement isn't reached. For the most part, it might vary by the time period, but if, for instance, the legislature, doesn't fund or, actually those are two different things. I think what I meant to convey with this slide is that if the parties don't reach an agreement, they'll go to interest arbitration. Also, if the parties have an agreement, they submit to the legislature and it doesn't get funded, then they would have to resume negotiations. And if they don't reach agreement, then it would go back to interest arbitration for the most part.
Okay. Does your department have any regular meetings with labor, even regularly scheduled, even in circumstances where there aren't any particular issues or requests? Are there any times where the sides meet and talk sort of organically about anything on their minds? I don't know.
Chair Josephson, different agreements require these like labor management committees where the parties meet, and there's some that are dedicated to specific purposes, and there are some that are just set aside for times for the parties to discuss issues as they arise. And so I would have to check with our labor relations manager to know which ones are taking place under which contracts right now, but those are provided for under the contracts.
All right, so we've talked about slide 11 a bit. None of us are experts on this except you. I don't mean to say, don't give us a quiz. And then you've got slide 12. And this is actually fairly helpful. Not that the other parts aren't, but it's an interesting slide that I encourage the members to look at. Anything you want to comment on it, Director?
Chair Josephson, first, I apologize for the size of the font, but this information is also available on the Department of Law Labor Relations webpage, and it is sort of helpful to give an overview of the different unions, the size, and the amount of the yearly pay for each one, and so it just kind of provides a snapshot, and that is updated on a yearly basis.
Okay. Representative Tomaszewski.
Yeah, thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. Thank you for being here. Appreciate it. You have given us a contract for the Correctional Officers Association. On page 47, you have wage adjustments. I just wanted to kind of go through that a little bit to see how that works exactly. That's page 47. And I'm looking at the top 25 compensated employees for corrections. And it looks like number one is a corrections nurse two. And so he or she has a base salary of $211,000, a benefit package of $203,000 for a total package of $415,000. And I'm just curious as to the proposals of wage increases, effective dates and all that. I guess that's the in red. So we have an effective date, July 1st, 2026, can you go through that and describe what that's going to do to this particular salary?
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, I don't know that I am an expert in the particular effect of, you know, applying percentages to employees under this contract. I can just speak generally that there would be a 5% increase to the wages of any employee covered under the contract for the first increase. Applying these percentages in the red line as of these dates to whatever employee at whatever wage they're at that time. Sorry, I'm not being more specific.
Okay, follow up.
Follow up.
So it says effective July 1st, 2026, or prospectively beginning the next pay period following receipt of the necessary legislative approval, whichever is latest, the wage scale in effect on July 1st, 2025 shall increase by 5%. So I'm just curious why the effective date says July 1st, 2026, and then it comes down further and says the effective date is July 1, 2025, shall increase by 5%. So I'm curious about that, but I'm also curious about, is that a 5% to the base salary? And I'm sure that affects the benefits at some point, or is that just a 5% across total benefits on that particular position?
Director Witte.
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, the two dates in there, so effective on July 1st, 2026, the wage increase is applied to whatever wages were in effect the previous fiscal year. So it's it's to the base wage rate across the board.
So it's the base salary.
Yes. Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski. I am not in the weeds on the negotiations of these contracts, and so if I'm misstating anything, I will need to have my folks correct me and submit a clarification to the committee.
Okay, follow up.
Mm-hmm. Follow up. Rep. Tomaszewski for your director.
And yes, through the chair, thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. So in regards to your statement just a few minutes ago about having this lump sum, I was just curious if they go back to 2025, add the 5% at July 1, 2026, and then you get that 5% one time, I guess, on Independence Day or somewhere around there. So that's kind of what I was curious about. And I was curious, I would imagine it has to affect the benefits, because when we put in our retirement, there's a certain match, and I would imagine that would bump that up also. But I was curious, one of the other corrections employees is a food service supervisor, and they're at the Kuskokwim Yukon Kuskokwim Correctional Center in Bethel. Their base salary is $90,000, but their benefit package is $206,000. So I'm just curious how that works. I'm looking at just below on that same page in 47, the geographic differential pay, where Bethel receives a 50% above basic pay. So can you just, I guess you probably don't know a whole lot about how that works and how that is happens to be, I guess there's some sort of premium pay maybe involved in that benefit package.
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Tomaszewski, I don't know how that particular benefit, what the breakdown is, why it is that amount. Yes, I mean, the geo differential just accounts for, you know, the difficulty in living in these areas in terms of the cost of living and the need to compensate for it. I don't know what the specific benefit package of that individual.
Okay, maybe a follow-up at some point on that. That would be just great for my curiosity. Thank you.
Rep Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson, through the chair. And this may also be a question that will require follow-up. I apologize if so. I am now magnifying these numbers on page 12. And my question is just the top line, because the correctional, we've added every year extra for the budget of corrections, and I'm trying to understand a little bit better. What I'm seeing on this top line, and I'd appreciate your help, is the average yearly pay is 84,000-ish, and then I see the average when I go to the overtime pay. What I see for all overtime, I think it says all next to it, is a total overtime. I think that's what OT means, but I'm not positive. I assume that's overtime, and it says all is $21 million of overtime. When I divide that up by approximately 100 full-time position or 100 total position, or sorry, 1,000 positions, or total members, the number, it gets to be very high. And I just want to make sure I understand that. Would that be accurate? Is that the right way to do that formula? Would be to take the 21 million, if I wanted to know just the average, 21 million divided by about 1,000. And that would give me the average full overtime per employee for a year?
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, that sounds right to me, but I can supplement with calculations of average overtime pay and verify.
The reason I ask that is I see that their average pay, I think, is 84,000, if I'm reading that right, average annual pay. But if I do that math that we just talked about, it brings me to 250,000 or so per employee, and I just want to make sure that I'm reading that right.
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Galvin, I will provide verification and make sure that we have accurate calculations for that. But I can add by way of explanation that some of these numbers might be high. In the previous calendar year, at the beginning of the calendar year, previous fiscal year, there was a letter of agreement that was in effect that allowed these employees to get double overtime rates for certain shifts. And that letter of agreement expired at the end of the fiscal year. And so these numbers might still be inflated for the first part of the calendar year because of that.
Okay, thank you.
Rep Hannon.
Thank you, Coach Josephson. I guess I wanted to just perhaps, because I'm familiar with that a lot sense. Of this bargaining language, because I bargained 7 contracts for the union that I represented and was a member of. But I noticed that the correctional officers was an arbitration award settlement going back to June 24th. So, Ms. Whitting, perhaps you could give a very brief discussion of the difference between a bargained contract that the department bargained and what it means to have an arbitrated settlement that may be capturing a time period that's going back. So although in the red, the dates on page 47 that Representative Tomaszewski was referencing, it is an arbitration that goes back a year prior and is probably capturing 2 calendar years of an arbitrated settlement that is slightly different than a bargained settlement.
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, this contract went through 2 rounds of arbitration. So they had an arbitration award in December of 2024, and as part of that award, the arbitrator made an award that covered years one and two of the contract, but then ordered the parties to go back to the table and try to bargain wages for year three. And so this past year, the parties did go back to the table. They were not successful in their own negotiations. Then they went to mediation and in the end had to go to an arbitrator again. And the arbitrator issued this award in November of 2025.
So just for clarification, so people understand, even though we have contract bargainers with some expertise, a federal arbitration is a binding settlement with an outside agency after a lengthy impasse to settle a contract that it looks like it was largely on wages, not on all aspects or many other aspects of the contract. And I'm just perusing it. I'm not reading through it. So, of course, when you have a wage arbitration, there's usually some shock and awe in the settlement of that to get it settled after a two rounds of arbitration with a return from the federal arbitrator to say, go back to the table, try this again, and then come back to us, and then it was arbitrated again. So I guess I'm just trying to underscore that the length of time and what we were probably paying to try and get to a settlement was time and money of both our state employees on both sides of the table, our contractors contributing to it, as well as a federal agency directed to settle a contract with these employees over wages. So although there's some shock and awe factor when we're sitting here, there's a really deep history that leads to that conclusion. And I don't know if you'd add anything to clarify that.
Director.
Through the chair, Representative Hannon, I think the one point of clarification would be that this is an arbitrator that's selected by the parties under the contract. And so it was an arbitrator that the parties agreed upon and as part of the contracting process.
Rep. Galvin.
Thank you, Co-Chair Josephson. For the record, I just wanted to make sure that I cleared up that I added an extra digit when I did my math. But I still look forward to hearing what you find out with regard to those numbers that are in very small font on the top line. Thank you very much. I appreciate you being here, Director Witte.
Okay. Director, I may have just a couple more questions. On the subject of I don't know if it's an official impasse, but where, for example, a bargaining unit declares that they're ready to negotiate just before Christmas Day, and then we're into April and there's no contract, what is to, in those circumstances, and you didn't say it was all of them, you didn't say how many it was, but in terms of retroactivity of a CBA, what is to disincentivize the state from postponing an agreement in order to save the state dollars? How it just strikes me that if you reach an agreement the hour after we adjourn and then the bargaining unit has to wait 11 months and 29 days, if you take my point, to the next closeout of a budget in the following year, that's a huge penalty for the failure of the parties to finish the agreement timely. What stops the state from doing that, from just postponement?
Representative Josephson, I mean, I think that both parties are required to negotiate in good faith. And so if, for instance, I think that the state is obligated to try and reach a timely resolution in order to get the contract funded and then advocate for that before the legislature. So And, you know, I think, as stated in our mission, it's not in the state's interest to have employees that are not getting paid their salary increase. So, the state team is working hard to get a resolution that can get funded by the legislature.
Okay. And I want the record to reflect that I don't even know which unions would not receive retroactive pay pursuant to their previous CBA, presumably, and which would. So I'm not speaking of anyone in particular. Is the state, and it's a similar question that I asked about OCS, is the state sensitive to, for example, it may be natural, even if technically improper, I guess, but a natural phenomenon if there were zero vacancies because the jobs seemingly were paid well, popular, et cetera, vis-a-vis situations where, for example, we know there are lots of vacancies at the state troopers and moving to closure on a negotiated agreement might act to incentivize a savvy trooper applicant who said, oh, look, I see some movement and this is, my future colleagues are receiving a 3% bump or something. Is the state aware, does the state take into account, is it allowed to take into account the number of vacancies effectively and where we need help in our agencies?
Chair Justice, and to make sure I understand I'll just key in on the last part of your question. I mean, yes, recruitment and retention are things that are taken into account during bargaining. And there are reports that are pulled to try and show, you know, whether there is a nexus between particular, you know, pay and vacancy rates. And so, I mean, those are all things that are factored in.
Okay. Director, you've been very forthcoming, and we appreciate it. You had lots of interesting questions fired at you. And I think we are, however, going to let you go back to your regular duties. You're welcome to hang out and hear about, don't tell me, a bill on peace officer and firefighter benefits. Actually, it could be relevant. But we're going to go at ease with our thanks to you, Director.
Thank you.
At 2:43. We're at ease at 2:43.
And House Finance back on record at 2:43 p.m. on Thursday, March 26, 2026. And we have one bill before the committee this afternoon, and that is House Bill 210. It's Peace Officers and Firefighters Disability by Representative Kopp. Today we will take public testimony and then set the bill aside, and I'd like to invite up Representative Kopp and his staff, Julia O'Connor, to please come to the table and put yourselves on the record and give us a recap before we start public testimony. And if time permits, we'll take more detailed questions after the close of public testimony. So also we'll be reviewing the fiscal notes when the bill is heard next. So with that, Representative Kopp, thanks for being here. And if you could give us a recap.
Thank you, Chair Foster and members of the House Finance Committee. For bringing this up again. House Bill 210 updates Alaska's occupational disability benefits for peace officers and firefighters who are permanently injured in the line of duty. The bill increases the benefit from 40% to 75% of salary after the first 12 months of disability. This change applies to both current persons on disability status and future recipients and is intended to provide more of an adequate income replacement for a small group of public safety employees that face career-ending injuries. That's pretty much the overview in a nutshell, Mr. Chairman.
Great. Thanks very much. Okay, so what we wanted to do was take public testimony on the bill today. And for folks who are watching and would like to submit written testimony, they can do so by emailing us at house.finance@akleg.com. I'll repeat that later, but one more time, that's house.finance@akleg.com. Sorry, .gov. I better say that one more time, house.finance@akleg.gov. And so for testifiers online, I guess, first of all, maybe I'd like to check to see if we have anybody in the room who would like to testify. And I'm going to open public testimony on House Bill 210. And I don't see anybody in the room who would like to testify, so we'll go online. And let's see here. Just a reminder, if folks online, if you're on a speakerphone, sometimes we can hear you better if we're not on speaker, and if you can get a little closer to the mic. So with that, first of all, we've got Mr. Scott Lanier. Looks like you're calling in from Bullhead City, Arizona. If you'd like to state your name and your affiliation and proceed with your testimony.
Good afternoon, sir. My name is Scott Lanier. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak in front of the committee today. Again, my name is Scott Lanier. I was an Alaska State Trooper for 14 and a half years before I lost my job due to the line of duty injury. I am currently receiving disability pay since April of 2024. I am letting the committee know that as one of the troopers that this bill will directly affect, I do support House Bill 210. While this bill doesn't fix all the problems with the current disability problems, it will alleviate some of the pain. If passed for the first time since I lost my career in 2024, I would finally be able to afford medical insurance. I would like the committee to make making this bill retroactive to all Tier 4 employees for first responders who and to help the folks that are currently on disability who have sacrificed for the citizens of the state of Alaska. Thank you for the opportunity to speak today, and I am available for questions.
Okay, thank you. Do we have any questions from the committee? Representative Galvin?
Thank you, Mr. Lanier. I just wanted to thank you for your 14 and a half years of service.
Thank you. Any further questions? Seeing none, Mr. Lanier, thank you for calling in. Next, we have Dominique Lozano calling in from Fairbanks. If you can state your name and your affiliation.
Yes, this is Dominic Lozano, President of Alaska Professional Firefighters. So I just wanted to thank the Finance Committee today for hearing this bill and recognizing the lack of a sufficient coverage for disabled public safety workers. House Bill 210 is an attempt to change disability coverage from 40% of gross monthly salary to 75% and improves public safety members' lives who are suddenly injured on the job and can no longer work again. In the past, we've had lots of fights with either DRB or members of the legislature in your guys' building now over these benefits and how they're interpreted in those sense. So this goes a long way to make up for some of those, and it improves the financial aspect for members that are injured on the job. Giving permanently injured members the financial security to pay for their bills and continue to support their families is crucial and deserved. The Alaska Professional Firefighters supports this legislation and urges quick passage out of committee. Thanks.
Okay, thank you very much. Do we have any questions of the committee? I don't see any questions. So with that, Mr. Lozano, thank you very much. Again, this is public testimony for House Bill 210, and that's the Peace Officers and Firefighters Disability Bill. And if anyone would like to submit written testimony, they can email us at house.finance@akleg.gov. And so I don't see any other testifiers, so I'm going to go ahead and close public testimony on HB 210. And that's all I've got on my agenda for today. But if folks have questions for the sponsor, certainly willing to open it up to that. Otherwise, we'll come back to our next meeting where we will review fiscal notes for the bill. So do we have any questions for the sponsor? I don't see any questions. Representative Ellard?
Sorry, my memory escapes me on the process lately. Co-chair, did we already do amendments for this one? Or are we still in the process of listening to public testimony and that kind of stuff?
Representative Ellard, we had the first hearing on March 19, and then today we're doing public testimony, and then the next meeting we'll do fiscal notes, so we have not done amendments yet.
Okay, I appreciate that. Thank you.
Sure. Okay. Seeing no questions, Representative Kopp, do you want to add anything? Otherwise, we'll look at the fiscal notes at our next meeting.
No, Chair Foster, I greatly appreciate the committee bringing this up again. And I would just add, in the earlier committee, we heard there was an outpouring of former troopers that are in this status and other disabled public safety members. So please don't take the brevity of the testimony as a lack of need out there. But this will certainly go a long ways, and I really appreciate the committee hearing it.
Thank you. Okay, well, we're at the end of our meeting, and our next meeting is scheduled for tomorrow, March 27th at 1:30 p.m., and at that meeting we'll take public testimony for Senate Bill 146, that is the REAA Fund, Mountain Edgecombe and Teacher Housing Bill. And our first hearing will also be held tomorrow on House Bill 77, that's the Mail Theft Bill. So if there's nothing else to come for the committee, Representative Bynum has a question.
Thank you, Co-Chair Foster. Were we able to, and to the chair, were we able to get a CS for that a bill, or will that be something that's still delayed?
You're reading my mind. I was wondering that same thing. Mr. Anderson, could you come up and tell us about the progress of the CS for that bill?
For the record, Brody Anderson, staff to Representative Foster. Representative, through the chair, it is in the works. We had not received it at the start of the 1:30 meeting, but I did have a conversation with legal prior to this meeting that the CS would be delivered and able to be looked at before the start of the 1:30 meeting tomorrow.
Thank you.
Great. Okay, so with that, we will stand adjourned at 2:52 p.m. Thank you.